Our final speaker is again a name familiar, I'm sure, to most of you, Professor Forrest MacDonald of the University of Alabama. He is a prolific author, the author at last count of about 15 books, several of which have been nominated for Pulitzer Prizes, including such classics as We the People, The Economic Origins of the Constitution, E Pluribus Unum, and a recent biography of Alexander Hamilton. With pleasure that I introduce Forrest MacDonald, and let's hope that our luck lasts a few minutes longer.
Thank you. One could begin to get paranoid about this and assume that the fates are against one. When I delivered my paper at a Hillsdale conference, can you hear me? Am I hitting the microphone? A couple of months ago, out of which this session grew, the speaker went dead. But it didn't go dead because I could have shouted, and I had a prepared paper, and I could have done it. But it went dead intermittently. It came on and off. And now we have a wedding party, the miracles of modern technology next door. Not weddings, but the sound system. I must say, though, as conservatives, we all believe devoutly in the family, and therefore we should believe devoutly in weddings. Now, this particular wedding has put me off somewhat on account of they began to check into the hotel, as some of you may have noticed, at 4:45 this morning, and didn't want to go to bed, and they woke us up, and like that, and combined that with this, and I began to feel like Keggs the butler in one of the P.G. Wodehouse stories, who was being interviewed by a young man who's very discontented. Keggs the butler is very discontented at being in America on Long Island. And he says, "What don't you like about the place?" And he says, "Well, there are too many Swedes around here in the first place, all the servants." He said, "What don't you like about the Swedes?" And he said, "They all have square heads." And he says, "Well, what else?" "Well, there are too many Irish around." "Well, what don't you like about the Irish?" "Well, because they're Irish." And then the conversation goes on a little ways, and he says something about, "But you have to think of posterity." And he says, "No, I don't have to think about posterity. I don't like posterity either." And he says, "Why don't you like posterity?" And Keggs the butler says, "I see no need for it, sir." I'm not normally sympathetic with that point of view, but all right. They're going to start right back up very soon, I know. Or just when I get my brain engaged, they will start back up. You will have noticed, I call this to your attention, that Paul and John had papers written out. I've got some notes scribbled here, which very nice, except I can't read the damn things. They're in a little bitty tiny writing. So let me say before the music starts that if I fall apart or if I don't get to the point or whatever, I'm going to try to get around to asking the question, is conservatism today infested with its various enemy, modernity? And if I don't get that far, my answer is going to be yes, okay? Let me begin by attempting to define my terms, both conservatism and modernity, as we have been taught by Professor Kirk. Conservatism as a cohesive, more or less organized, more or less systematic body of political and social and broader thought is a fairly new phenomenon coming into existence in the late 18th century, despite the fact that all the building blocks were there, or at least were in process of evolution over many, many, many centuries since ancient times. It came into being with Burke, really, in response to the first realization on the part of Western man that the fruits of modernity were bitter indeed. As manifested in the French Revolution. Modernity, let me try to define modernity as I shall be using the term first off. See, I'm looking at these notes, but I can't see them. I could probably see them if I look like that, but anyway. Modernity's first flourish begins late in the 17th century as an outgrowth of the long-standing struggle between the ancients and the moderns. The ancients always having maintained that in the ancient world, in the classical world, everything was better. The moderns get a shot in the arm from Descartes, who does invent a little bit of mathematics and a few things like that, and showing that something that the ancients had never thought of, accordingly, the moderns pick up the argument and say, if we can think of one thing, we can think of all things. The line of descent from Descartes to the horrible forms of modernity as we're faced with them, and as Burke was faced with them, runs from Descartes through, on the scientific side, through Newton, and in the social side, through Locke, and from Locke to the French Enlightenment, and from the French Enlightenment to its most horrible progeny, Rousseau, and from Rousseau to Robespierre, and happy days are here again. The essence of modernity, I think I can get to in along the following line. You get to Newton, and Newton, a very devoutly religious man, nonetheless postulates essentially God the infinite clockmaker, right, who set the world into motion, and it's a marvelous, marvelous, wonderful machine, and it just unfolds. There is no need for a God any longer who is the God who sees the fallen sparrow. There is no need for the God who interferes in human affairs. There is no need for a personal God, etc., etc. It is not a very long step from God the clockmaker to not really needing God in the equation at all. And it is not a terribly long step, because it didn't take until the middle of the 18th century to get there, from that to the deification of human reason, the idea that man himself, with the reason that he was given by God the clockmaker, or just has by nature, man himself is a rational creature. Man himself is God. It is not far, a very far step from there to get what I regard as the very essence of modernity, which is the notion that mankind can, by virtue of his reason, can restructure his society and restructure himself and reach perfectibility. Back to Eden, no more original sin, and so on. The notion that man's brain can bring heaven on earth, right? It's secular millennialism, right? It's a secular religion which believes in perfection here on earth by virtue of man's own capacity to reason and to engineer. All right. Conservatism arose in the form in which we know it as a reaction against that, or as I say, and as Professor Kirk has pointed out, against the horrors of the French Revolution which came out of that. To paraphrase again, essentially, Professor Kirk, I'm not sure I should say that because he's... that man has a universal religious sense. Number two, man has universally a moral sense, by which we mean the capacity to discern the difference between right and wrong. Number three, that there is a difference between right and wrong, that there is evil. Let me see, because I wrote these down in an order that I could follow, that there are moral values, eternal moral values, and that there are eternal moral truths. Next, because I've forgotten my numbers, that there are relative moral values as well, values which are profound and deep and valid for a particular society at a particular place and time, though not universally so, and that there are truths of the same magnitude. Number five, I'll get back to the numbering system, the principle of the recognition that evil is, that imperfectibility is, that we all, well, original sin, that we all contain within ourselves certain amounts of evil, and therefore that neither man nor society is ever perfectible. Number six, given that since society and man are not perfectible, that prescription, that is, the order that is passed down to us through the ages, in mysterious ways sometimes, is the safest reliance as our guide to what the social order should be. And finally, that when circumstances tell us that there must be change, that something has to give, that is not working, that the prescriptive formulas do not work or don't seem to be working, that prudence should be our guide in bringing about change. All right. So these are the ways that I would define modernity and conservatism as a response to modernity. Now, if, as conservatives maintain, the religious impulse is really there, and it is universal, that is, man has a religious impulse, what happens in the last couple of hundred years when this religious impulse is denied? Right? We don't have it, or we disown it, or we disclaim it, or whatever. When it's either denied, or when, as in most forms of modernism, of modernity, it is secularized. Well, I would submit that things happen in three general areas, at least three general areas. In the first place, you get the rise of idolatry, right? The worship of false gods in the narrowest and most literal sense of the term. But in another sense, idolatry means the making absolute out of something which is relative, right? Now, it seems to me that, as Paul has suggested, not only does modernity lead to, or at least have a strong element of totalitarianism, absolutism built into it, I think it leads invariably to some form of absolutism or some form of totalitarianism. For the reason, very simple reason, that if you're going to make heaven on earth, if you're going to perfect humankind, you're going to perfect human society and every individual in it, and various people don't want to be perfected, what are you going to do? Ain't nothing you can do except wipe them out, because they're enemies of humankind. Are they not? They're enemies of human progress. Are they not? Now, in the conservative movement, here it comes, in the conservative movement, we don't have very many that I have met, and we've all met lots of sometimes very exotic and strange varieties of conservatives. We don't have many who are really dedicated totalitarians. We have very few who would admit that they even lean in that general direction. But I would submit that the idea of idolatry, the making of an absolute out of a relative, is to be found among a lot of us, right? I think offhand, I see my good pal Lynn Ligge over there. I think of his good pal and my good pal also, Murray Rothbard, who is got to be the number one guru of libertarianism. And it seems to me Murray borders very, very strongly upon idolatry in the way I've defined it, if he doesn't indeed cross the line. All you got to do is sell the White House back to private enterprise and sell the streets back to private enterprise and abolish government and take away all arbitrary power, and everybody will be wonderful. The freer man is, the better he is, right? That borders very close on it. It seems to me, also, I may alienate everybody in the room before I'm through. It seems to me that there's a very strong streak of this form of idolatry amongst the Straussians. Harry Jaffa, my God, and his postulation of the absolute nature of inalienable human rights. This borders very, very strongly on it also. I don't see much signs of this among the Reagan administration, but there's another aspect to this kind of mentality, the idolatrous trend, seems to me, and that is that you can't let things happen, right? You gotta manage everything. You gotta run everything, even if running everything means abolishing running everything, as with Murray. And we've certainly had symptoms in the Reagan administration on tax policy, getting concerned about the deficit. The deficit has become practically the antichrist in the Reagan administration and has to be stamped out at all costs, including taking 120% of everybody's income. Right. Secondly, it seems to me that when you get a denial of the religious impulse which exists, or you secularize the religious impulse, as we all tend to do, even among the more religious of us. The second thing that happens is you get, see, if you kill God, you kill Satan too. And if man needs God, he needs Satan too. And you get yourself into this situation, and what follows is you have got to invent, to satisfy a cardinal human need, you've got to invent a secularized demonology. Right? You gotta invent devils. It wasn't very long after Newton died that Henry St. John, 1st Viscount Bolingbroke, invented the first and most pervasive of all the secularized demonologies in opposition to Robert Walpole and the Financial Revolution in England and so on. He invented a terribly, terribly modern set of notions about the evils of the ministerial system, which is less relevant to us now, but also the evils of the financial revolution, the evils of money. Money is the root, or the love of money, or paper money, or high finance and transactions like that were, to Bolingbroke, the root of it all. If you don't think that's terribly modern, somebody mentioned this afternoon Threepenny Opera. Threepenny Opera was written by John Gay, who was a disciple and cohort of Bolingbroke's. It was a denunciation of the nascent, the coming into being capitalist world from the other end, that is, before we got there. And it was a terrible denunciation of it. Okay. In the late 1920s, early 1930s, two German Marxists, Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht, took the Beggar's Opera and turned, which was, did I say Threepenny Opera? He wrote the Beggar, John Gay wrote the Beggar's Opera. They took the Threepenny Opera, the Beggar's Opera, turned it into the Threepenny Opera. Much of the same words, much of the same music, and just it works. You know, it's as vicious a criticism of capitalism from this end of the stick as it was from the other end of the stick. All right, from Bolingbroke, the line of descent in this secular demonology runs through in Europe. It runs through the Scottish Enlightenment, through Marx, and on through to Lenin, and so on, and various forms of socialism. In the United States, it had a much more diverse and plural course, but it ran, again, through the Scottish Enlightenment, through the Anti-Federalists, there goes Mel Bradford, to the Jeffersonians, and to the Jacksonians, and to the Anti-Slavery Crusade, and through the populists, and on up to George C. McGovern and beyond. And it's pretty much the same. There's somebody out there that's the root of evil, right? There are things that are wrong, and there ain't no devil, and it must be, you know, the money conspiracy. At one point it was Alexander Hamilton, at another point it was Nicholas Biddle, at another point it was John C. Calhoun and the slaveocracy, and when you get rid of all these guys and you still don't have a heaven on earth, then you discover the railroad monopolist, and then you study, you discover finance cap, and it goes on and on. You know how that works. And we've discovered Demon Rum and various other people along the way, too, but the point is that this is satisfying a basic human need for demons or for Satan. Okay. Thirdly, and I don't know how the hell I'm going to end this thing, because I really do want to get to a terribly serious note. Thirdly, what you get is, in these circumstances, you get a denial of evil itself, right? Satan's most diabolical technique is to convince you that he ain't there, that there's no such thing as himself, his satanic highness. There's no such thing as evil. And here, I left out a line. The line I left out was that the root of all evil this afternoon when our friend from the White House was talking was who? Liberals. Right? God, everything that goes wrong in this planet is due to the liberals. It's the same thing as the military-industrial complex and the railroad conspiracy and the banking conspiracy and all the rest, right? All right, moving on to my point about evil, my final point. I guess I came to this by virtue of what I've been reading lately, poisoning my mind. I read to review for National Review a biography of Franklin Roosevelt. Not a very good biography, but an adequate biography. And then I read, not for review, Robert Cairo's biography of Lyndon Baines Johnson. And this really started me to thinking, you know, of all the genuine, to my way of thinking, the genuine sources of evil in this world, you need look no further than Washington, D.C. and some of our beloved politicians. Franklin Roosevelt was a man in a vacuum, right? He was playing the political game. He was essentially amoral, we would say. But you can't be amoral. He was a fundamentally immoral man. He was a fundamentally evil man because he didn't once considered. He played his political game and never once considered the consequences of what he was doing. He was not interested in the consequences of what he was doing. Moving right along to Lyndon Baines Johnson. If you've read the Cairo biography, I need say no more. If you haven't read the Cairo biography, read it. It's a horror show. The man, it's right on the button. The man, Johnson, was driven by a love of power and a love of money, a passion for controlling other human beings with no notions whatsoever, no consideration whatsoever as to the political, social, religious, economic, any other consequences of what he did. He loved power and he loved money and he would do anything to get it. If that meant he had to talk out of this side of his mouth or that side of his mouth or that side, he would do it, right? And the destruction he wrought as a consequence is practically immeasurable. In our own enlightened times, we need point no further than Teddy Kennedy is an evil man. I mean, everybody. If you stop, you know, he's an evil man. Tip O'Neill is an evil man. He does not consider the consequences of what he does. He's absolutely for Tip O'Neill. Teddy Kennedy is absolutely for Teddy Kennedy. And now I'm going to alienate all the rest of you. In the Reagan administration, it seems to me that, well, like a lot of us, like a lot of you, I think, I've been puzzled why it went wrong, what went wrong, and things like that. And what I come down to is this, that the president, having a mandate, being a very moral man himself, came into office and could have and should have done something very dramatic, instead decided to operate through the existing power structure and such stuff as that. And though we like to think that all the evil people are in the Democratic Party, the four I've named so far have been staunch Democrats, what I come down to is this. He had to deal with a majority in the United States Senate, which meant that he had to deal with two people of the caliber of Lyndon Baines Johnson and Franklin Roosevelt and Teddy Kennedy and Tip O'Neill, namely Howard Baker and namely Robert Dole. You're dealing with these men with evil. And if you do not recognize evil, it's going to get you. Thank you.